Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Do you pay attention to coincidences? Today's guest says you should. Dr. Bernard Beidman is a graduate of Yale Medical School and did his psychiatric residency at Stanford University. He was chair of psychiatry at the University of Missouri-Columbia Medical School for 17 years, and he writes a blog for Psychology Today. Dr. Beidman wrote a previous book on meaningful coincidences. Today I'm going to ask him about his newest book, Life-Changing Synchronicities, A Doctor's Journey of Coincidence and Serendipity. Dr. Bernard Beidman, welcome.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
You know, I open your book and I see the dedication, and it's not to a family member like some people do. Who did you dedicate your book to?
Carl Jung.
And why was that?
He started this synchronicity business, at least for Western minds. It was probably his most important contribution. He helped start AA. He's helped develop personality types, both of which are enduring and being used, the ideas behind them. But synchronicity was his more outrageous contribution to modern science, since it suggests by direct personal experience that reality is not the way we are taught that it is. It's not materialistic. We are much more connected to each other and to our environment than science currently tells us we are.
You had an endorsement by a scientist, a quantum physicist, and he says, well, your point you make about entanglement, said, yeah, that exists. But I don't think most scientists would want to write a blurb for your book, doctor.
It depends on what you mean by most. It's a... And the world is often characterized as being described by the bell-shaped curve, the normal curve, the kind of thing that says height and weight are normally distributed. There's tiny people and there's big people. Well, it's true in physics. The more people get into physics, the more mysterious it becomes. The more this quantum thing becomes confusing about the nature of reality. And quantum physicists know very well that the old way of thinking about reality is wrong. Entanglement is a very popular way of talking about how things are different now. And entanglement in quantum physics means you take a particle, maybe split it in two, and then separate that split particle, those two pieces, by a large distance, and you do something to one of those particles, like change its spin, and instantaneously, even a million miles away, the spin of the other particle, an electron or a photon, will change. So they are entangled beyond what we think of as time and space, because the change takes place instantly. Well, that's weird. That's not the way we think of reality. So quantum physicists, as this person who wrote the endorsement, know that there's much more to this reality than we are being told. And quantum physicists are actually leading the way into this mystery.
My guest is Dr. Bernard Beidman, and his newest book is Life-Changing Synchronicities, A Doctor's Journey of Coincidence and Serendipity. And that doctor is you, doctor. And that, did you have any hesitation to writing about yourself so personally?
Yes. Yes, I did. I tend to try to be objective, writing about findings of other people, putting it together perhaps in some way that's more cohesive than what's been done in the past, which is what I did with my previous book on coincidences called Meaningful Coincidences. It's kind of a textbook of synchronicity, which hasn't been done. Jung was the first one to try to organize synchronicity into categories. And I'm the next one, next psychiatrist anyway, who's tried to do the same thing in a much more elaborate way, since there's much that we've learned since Jung first wrote about it.
You know, you mentioned the word textbook, and I could see in reading your book, I could see the teacher in you by the way you formatted your book. How did you format your book?
Well, I'd like to go back to the question about my caution in writing it about myself, because I appreciate the question. It was not easy to think about doing it. It was the easiest book I've ever written, because I remember so many of these things. And there's so many coincidences in my life, starting from quite young to current ones that are not in the book, and many in between. So it gave me a chance to do a kind of life review. I didn't have to have a near-death experience. I could just write about my coincidences and look back at the patterns. So for me, it was a good exercise. But the real difficulty was putting myself out there in such a personal way. That was cautious. I didn't like, oh, me, me, me. I mean, there's so much narcissism in this world now, where people think they're just wonderful and don't think about the minds of other people. Yes, you laugh because you know that to be the case.
Well, just recently in the airport, a woman sat down beside me and she talked forever about herself. And I thought, yeah, there's an example right there of what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. One of the issues that I'm trying to deal with in a current book I'm writing is just that, Nancy, is how people will not tune into, in this case, your mind. They will not pay attention to their impact on you. And it's really getting disgusting to me. There you are sitting there as polite as you often are. I don't say always, but often. And you want to say something like, shut up and let me talk, or why don't you ask about me, or I'm here too, or something like that.
Well, actually, what I said was, I've been sitting so long, I'm going to get up and take a walk, and I just paced back and did a few laps there in the way at the gate. But
you had to get out of there.
Yeah.
You had
to get and I wanted to do it tastefully, you know.
And you did, of course, you would do that. And that's the right thing to do. I was doing that with talking with a woman, hopefully having a dialogue, and she just went on and on. And my response was, you're taking advantage of me. And she was. And that's where I've gotten to now, being able to say authentic responses to a person like that, who's very nice, very intelligent, very interested in coincidences, but not at all recognizing that she, like another person at dance, was just talking at me because she had an audience. And it's these are dialogues, ladies and gentlemen. These are two people. Let's keep in mind the mind of the person with whom you're talking. And that's what I'm doing writing this book. That's what I am doing. And so I was able to do what you have so clearly illustrated in your own experience, Nancy, with this book, that the stories in this book, Life-Changing Synchronicities, remind you of yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's why I wrote the book, as a mirror of the mind of the reader, not so much about me, but to do what happened to you. Why don't you tell us what happened to you reading the book?
Well, it took me a long time, because I would read one of your stories and it would spark my own recollections of, oh yeah, something quite similar happened to me. So many times that I would read, whether it was yours or some other story, and that would be my reaction. It would make me stop and think about, oh yeah. And some of them I hadn't really realized how synchronicity and serendipity were involved, or could be labeled that. What happened to me could be labeled that way. And you mentioned why you wrote this book, and I mentioned a little bit earlier that I could see the teacher in you, because I thought, oh gosh, if people would just pay attention to these lessons, even if they think you're a little too far out there, doctor, I don't know if I can go along, but so much of what you say makes sense.
Well, that's important.
you even say you've been labeled psychotic, Dr. Biteman.
I've had the privilege of being labeled psychotic. Yes, I have.
Well, then.
Oh, yeah.
Are psychosis and synchronicity related?
Yeah. They're related in the minds of many mental health professionals. What I describe in the book was that when I was a resident at Stanford, resident in psychiatry, I was also a part-time hippie in San Francisco. And I went back and forth between a residency training and Haight Street, and it was great. And I was learning about synchronicity on the streets of San Francisco. I kind of remember a sign that says synchronicity spoken here. A lot of people knew it. And I was bringing ideas about synchronicity into the residency program and talking about those things with fellow residents. And a very kind, caring resident in my group politely asked me to come to his office because I was talking about tarot cards, which are a long-standing way of being able to predict the future.
There's no scientific support for such rubbish as tarot cards. I'm actually quoting your book that these tarot cards, there's no scientific support for such rubbish. So then, happened?
Science doesn't want to look at it. That's why. I mean, you're not going to find support if you don't like the idea to begin with. And the I Ching has been around longer than Western science, which is also related to divination, predicting the future. And I cannot argue with anybody who says they know that these things are rubbish, because that's that person's opinion. And so it was more than rubbish when I was talking about tarot cards among my residents, fellow residents, when this fellow resident called me in his office and said, you're talking about these synchronicity things and the tarot card things. You're psychotic, Bernie, and you need help.
Forgive me for laughing, but go ahead. Sorry.
I laughed kind of inside myself. This guy's a really nice guy. He's a psychiatrist in Portland, and I know people who know him, and he's just a real nice guy. And he was just trying to be helpful, because that's the standard way of thinking about people talking like this. It was meant that I was psychotic. That's what mental health people do, is talk about synchronicity means you're psychotic. And the fact is that there are many people who are manic, are in manic states, and they are experiencing too many synchronicities, and they become overwhelmed by them because their minds are going so fast that they're putting so many different things together that they can't make sense out of them. They become perplexed by all the information coming into them that they can't make sense about. So they become disturbed, or the synchronicities become a symptom of their disturbance, kind of a feedback loop that gets them into trouble. But I went to some of America's finest schools. Swarthmore College is a very good small college. I went to Yale Medical School. I've been trained to be discriminating in my observations. That's what being a doctor is to make sense out of what's in front of you. And if I saw so many of these, not only in my own life, but other people talking about them, and there seemed to be something to them, then I was making an observation about reality that deserved some attention. And like Jung, I took many years to write about it. Jung was afraid to, because he was afraid he would get the same feedback that my friendly resident gave me, that he was being psychotic. So he didn't write about synchronicity. He talked about it, but didn't write about it until later in his life. And that's what's happened with me. I've written the three books on meaningful coincidences since 2016. I did research, and this is what we have to do. I said, well, do these things really happen? Is it just me and just the hippies on Haight Street and other things? Or how often, how frequent are meaningful coincidences? So I got some research assistance when I was a chairman of psychiatry at the University of Missouri, Columbia. And we created a valid and reliable scale. That's what you have to do to have a scale that you can trust. And gave it to 1,000 people at the University of Missouri. And sure enough, a lot of people had lots of different coincidences. So what's the most common coincidence, do you think, Nancy?
Oh, my goodness. Maybe you're sitting at home and you get a phone call that you and you were thinking about that person, and sure enough, that's the person who phoned you. No, that's not the most common.
It's one of the most common. It's probably the most common when I ask people like you when I'm being interviewed like this, that same question. That's the same answer every time. Thinking of someone and they contact me, yeah. Or they contact you. It's the same answer. And what's the problem with? I mean, what's the problem here? We have a repeated phenomenon. The phone call when you're thinking about somebody, and usually you haven't thought about them for a long time. It makes it less probable for that to happen. So many, many people report the same common coincidence. Well, that's the way medicine and psychiatry proceed. You make an observation that looks like it's odd. It's different from a lot of other observations that have gone to this time. And then you start collecting a bunch of cases, and you collect those cases and you come up with possibility that there's something to this because you now have 10 cases. I did that with a depressed person who went to the dentist and had a lot of pain and was given codeine for the pain, and his depression went away. And then he got depressed again, but then he became romantically involved and his depression went away. And in both cases, dopamine was increased and other molecules increased in the brain that seemed to correlate with diminishing the depression in him. I found two other cases, something like that. And then years later, I read a report of people giving narcotics like codeine to depress some depressed people, and they improved. It's called case studies that then become generalizable to larger populations.
My guest is Dr. Bernard Beitman. His latest book is Life-Changing Synchronicities, A Doctor's Journey of Coincidence and Serendipity. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Bernard Beitman, and he has written about his journey of coincidence and serendipity. Now, you mentioned in your book, too, that, I was wondering who would publish a book that's so out there, unscientific, and you even say that Oxford University Press balked at including telepathy in your book, Doctor.
Oxford didn't want it because of telepathy.
Yeah. So you often say, though, that one door closes, another door opens. And that might have been an example that, well, maybe this publisher didn't want it, but this publisher, that door closed, but another door opened and you got it published. I think a lot of the things that you say, even if people don't go along with your unscientific approach, could say, yeah, I think I'll view this firing from this job as an opportunity. And you say that imagine what you want. Imagining helps create the future. So I'm thinking in this time when people may be losing their jobs, okay, but there's a better job, a job I like even more for whatever reason, and that helps create the future. I sat next to a woman on the, again, we're in an airplane, and she had similar feelings, and she says her daughter often says, "Mother, manifest." I thought, yeah, I like that. What do you say about manifestation?
Well, that's the beginning of talking about what you just talked about, then. Imagining. Manifestation is based on the supposed law of attraction. There probably is a thing about opposites attracting as well as likes attracting. It happens in magnetism for sure. But a law that has to do with thinking about something and then that something appears, it needs a little bit more investigation. The trouble that I found with the law of attraction and manifesting in its earlier version, The Secret 2009 book, was a big popularizer of this idea, is that you can't, for me, they advised if you wanted some money, you put a photograph or an illustration of a $1,000 bill on the ceiling of your bedroom and lay down on your bed and stare at that $1,000 bill and the money is going to come. That's not enough. You got to do something. And many people have now recognized that it's not enough to imagine or do a vision board of what you want to have happen. You've got to act. And without acting, you don't increase the likelihood of running into people or ideas or things that might be what you're looking for. So that if just sitting still in your house and imagining is unlikely to happen. And manifestation is going to have to be within the realm of possibility. So if I'm an Eskimo in an igloo in 1930, and I'd like to have a camel come by and sell me a Persian rug, that's quite unlikely, however much I might think about it happening. So it has to be within the realm of possibility. So you have to move, you have to act, and you, by having in mind what you want, then you'll see it. That's what's important. In all of this, it's being curious and alert and looking around. So when you're manifesting, you're looking for possibilities.
You know, another example that's rather humorous, you talk about that dog looking for a bone, or he's not going to find it sitting in his nest or his dog bed in the house. What does he do? You tell us, what does he do if he wants to find a bone?
Well, the dog that trots about finds the bone. I mean, you got to get out of the house. And that's an old saying from maybe the 1500s. But I've added the dog that trots about near a butcher shop finds the bone. You increase the probability.
So you you actually give us a lot of lessons, I think, that would be that we should consider. And one of them you mentioned to visualize or imagine what that helps create the future. And I read you have a section on Deus ex machina. And so many times this expression has popped into my head lately because of political situations and well, for example, I was walking the pilgrimage across to Santiago de Compostela and came to a night where there's a tiny little village, the little hostel was filled, and thought, oh, what are we going to do? I didn't carry a sleeping bag because I never expected not to have a place when night came to stay. And this woman pulled up in a station wagon. This is France now, in a station wagon. And she says, I'll take you to the next town. And so that was not a solution I ever dreamed of. It was Deus ex machina, that out of nowhere, this solution you never dreamed of comes.
That's wonderful. I love those. And how do you explain those? It's hard. And I explain it in part by need. People might call it manifesting, but you had a need, and somehow that person in the station wagon recognized your need. And did you ever ask her how come she stopped to pick you up?
No, I think she may have told us, but I don't recall because this was quite a few years ago. Another thing that I was amused by in your book that I thought very unlikely, you mentioned that people's names often reflect what they do. Dr. Tooth, probably be a dentist. And I thought, well, I can't see that exactly. But then I remembered that when I was in high school, my maiden name was Basham. I played tennis, and there was a newspaper article about me, and they played on the word Basham. I was on the tennis courts, and I bashed them. So I think your book will stimulate thoughts that people would not or normally occur to them, like my saying I was Basham. So do you have other examples that people maybe have read your book and said, oh my gosh, Bernie, never thought of that?
Well, I don't know what the reader hasn't thought of, so I have trouble answering that question. I think some of the strange things are like your story of having a need and not knowing what to do about it. And it's somehow you get an answer. I've heard that story other times. Some people lost their camping equipment. It was stolen, and they pulled into a place where they would have camped, and some other people said, we have some extra camping equipment. Do you want to use it? And it was exactly the same stuff that that had been stolen from them. And those feel like miracles when they happen. They illustrate how interconnected we are in ways that we don't ordinarily think about. So if you take your story and I add another one to it, like your station wagon story, and probably can find hundreds of others like that, then science does this thing, as I mentioned, of taking the individual cases and stringing them together. So one anecdote is just an anecdote, but a series of anecdotes is data. A series of anecdotes is data. And this data then, with your story, the one with I'm mentioning with the camper, with the campsite equipment, if there are hundreds of those, then we aggregate them and say, well, they're kind of similar. There's a need that unexpectedly gets met. What's going on here? And that's science. That's description. This stuff happens. These kinds of coincidences happen. So how do we begin to use them? How do we begin to explain them? And how can we increase the probability of their happening?
And you bring up the point often that you may not find you what you're seeking. You may not find what you don't quite know you're seeking. And I've had that happen with books. I think I'm looking up an answer for somebody else, and I find an answer that I had been pondering.
Oh, I love those. That's a definition of serendipity right there, which is looking for something and finding it in an odd way, an unexpected way. That's the story of serendipity. Some mistakes, like taking the wrong turn and then ending up someplace where you meet somebody who you wanted to meet, but they never got back to you, that story. There's all kinds of funny things that happen that we need to be able to get categorized and understand how they work.
And you mentioned, too, that having diversified experiences increase the likelihood of serendipity. So if you just sit on your sofa all day long in your house, then you're not helping yourself to, maybe people want to call it luck, being lucky, this serendipity. I think a lot of times when people retire and they've had things to do and then they limit their diversity, and this is one of the lessons in your book, I think, that even people don't go along with a lot of what you say, well, that's a good idea. I probably should get out more. And you say that this diversified atmosphere increases likelihood of serendipity.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense to you, how that works?
Oh, it does. It does. And a good place I think you would recommend that people go, if you're going to get out of your house, immerse yourself in nature. And what can happen? Why would I want to go out in nature, Doctor?
Why would you want to go out in nature? Because, my dear, it's good for you. It's remarkable how many people just restrict themselves to their own homes. And nature is a whole different thing. Much synchronicity happens among and between people and things. But the forest is a magical place, has been for much of human history. And most human beings are stuck watching a screen, either in their hand or on their computer, when there's so much going on out there that if you can tune into, if you read the latter part of my book, you'll see all kinds of stories about my relationships with trees.
Yeah. There are whole books written about that. I have books on my shelf about that.
Do any of them write about telepathy with trees?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
tell me about
the personalities. It's been a long time since I read them. But but reading your book, I recently visited family, and they had a forest in their backyard that included like banana trees. And I would sit out on the deck, and because I was reading your book, I thought, I'm going to put down my phone and I'm just going to look out at all the greenery, look up at the blue sky and watch the clouds float by. And when I looked up those clouds, I realized I had not done that since I was a child. And I thought, now that's a shame. So thanks to your influence, I paid more attention to that forest of trees, all kinds of trees, and that blue sky overhead. And we are fortunate here in Chico, we have a huge park that people can go to. And I think that is an attraction for a lot of people to come to this park. So you mentioned that sometimes a still, small voice comes to you, especially when immersed in nature. Now, what kind of small voice would come to you?
How about still small? Still and small. What kind of voice? I mean, I can't characterize it any better than that. And it's a phrase that's been used many times before I used it. And sometimes it's what you might call intuition. It's not really a voice. It's an idea that bubbles up in your mind. And maybe you don't hear a sound, but it's still some feeling with directions, like go this direction instead of that direction. You listen to guidance. It's takes a long time for many people to realize that there is potential guidance outside of somebody telling you what to do, or some book that tells you what to do, that we can tune into our own bodies and our own intuitions to have information available to us that is very, very helpful. Because there is stuff around us, which we can call stuff of all different kinds, in which we are being assisted. And some of that assistance comes through meaningful coincidences like serendipity and synchronicity, if you pay attention. And in the forest, you're away from digital. If you look around your house, everything tends to be linear. I mean, they're round things, but there tends to be lines, straight lines, squares and rectangles, your desk, your windows, the houses, they all have lines on them. You go out into nature and they don't do lines. they don't do lines. I mean, they do stuff that goes in all kinds of different directions. And sometimes trees are comedians when you start looking at them, because they're making, instead of making faces, they're kind of making all these different things with their branches. And especially like right now, we just had a big rain and I'm looking out the window and the trees are so happy, and I can feel the energy from the trees. I can feel the happiness. I was standing on the lawn with my bare feet, looking at all the trees that are around my house. And it was such a pleasure to be part of that with them, with the energy of the trees. That's nurturing for human beings. That's why you go out into nature. Nature wants to communicate with human beings. Part of the reason is like, what are you doing to us with all your destruction of forests and animals and yourselves? Come out with us. This is beautiful out here. The energy is great, and it'll be good for you. It'll help heal your soul. You'll feel much better being with us out here with the trees and the plants.
My guest is Dr. Bernard Beitman, and his book is Life-Changing Synchronicities, A Doctor's Journey of Coincidence and Serendipity. After a break, Dr. Beitman and I will be back to continue our conversation about synchronicities, coincidence, and serendipity. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Bernard Beitman. He is a psychiatrist and written a book about life-changing synchronicities. And you mentioned sometimes this still small voice will give you advice. And you mentioned in your book that your tendency was to say, why? It's suggesting you do something, and you say, why? But I no longer ask why, because I learned that I'll find out. And I used to rely too much on logic. And you're encouraging us to, if you want to call it intuition, which you did use that word. And I think people have experiences with when their intuition guided them to do something. You do mention in your book the expression recovering academic. And my late husband was an academic, but he didn't really recover. He just changed his emphasis and did volunteer teaching and really loved that. So I think if somebody is maybe looking for something new in their life, and just imagine, what is it that really brings me pleasure? They might follow some of your advice and find something that makes them even happier. Maybe imagining, like you say, imagining creates the future. Well, you mentioned reincarnation. And do people balk at that, Bernie, that you're including reincarnation in your book?
There's significant amount of data from research at the University of Virginia that suggests that children remember past lives. And you can't get away from it. It's like there. It's been a belief of many cultures for many years. I'm still modestly doubtful about it, but as the data comes in and I hear many more stories of people communicating with loved ones who have died, you kind of like get some idea that maybe there's more going on here with our lives continuing after our bodies go, and that some of them may come back in a different form on this planet.
Well, I want to make one other point that I don't want to say anything bad about physicians, because I really am sympathetic with them these days. We don't have enough of them here in Chico. But you express a mistrust of physicians and a distrust of allopathic medicine. Now, that won't bring you any friends, I think, MDs. Other MDs, doctor. So why do you say you mistrust physicians?
If you have, as it happened to me, a very well-meaning surgeon looking at my father, whose belly is protruding, and not knowing why, and cutting my father open, this is before the CAT scans and MRIs, cutting my father open to see what was going on, because you had to do laparotomies those days to see. And there was a bulging artery. It was an aneurysm of his hepatic artery. And this very well-meaning surgeon put a 25-gauge needle in that ballooning artery and made my father bleed out into his abdomen, which required a helicopter lift from Wilmington, Delaware to Philadelphia, where he had two emergency surgeries because the first surgery did not do it correctly. And then to watch him die over a year, go from a vigorous 64-year-old man to an 80-year-old man at age 64, made me begin to lose trust. And keep in mind that I am educated within medical schools. I'm not somebody looking at this from the outside. So I've had experiences within medicine to see the terrible limitations, the rigidity of physicians in the way they think about things. A cardiologist who insisted that I go for a study of my heart so that I could get a pacemaker put in when I didn't need a pacemaker and it wouldn't have been paid for anyway. And he scared me enough that my blood pressure went up to 190 as a result of having this evaluation done. And other things he said to scare me about what I needed to do. And also hearing story from a friend of mine of neurologist looking at a woman who was starting to have symptoms of multiple sclerosis. He went out into the hallway and brought her in a wheelchair and said, "This is what your future is." There is a lack of compassion and openness among too many physicians that younger physicians are starting to try to break through from. There's a lot of good in medicine. I have had prostate cancer, and they were able to cure it. There probably were other ways to be able to do it, but the radiation had some side effects that I'm still living with, but it still cured the prostate cancer. There's a lot of good in medicine, but there's a lot of horrible, narrow thinking. And so a friend of mine has started integrative medicine, where he's tried to be able to integrate ideas from other cultures, India and China in particular, and to emphasize, Nancy,
Oh, my goodness. But they aren't trained. Physicians, I don't think, or maybe a little mention, but they don't get nutrition training in medical schools, as I understand.
Why are you defending physicians now, Nancy?
Tell me, I'm serious about that. Some very nice physicians here in Chico, and one neurosurgeon wrote a book. I sat across the table from him, and at the end of the interview, I felt refreshed, and I thought to myself, now there's a healer. And I don't think all of them are, but I see your point definitely. But I feel that.
There are good ones all over the place. Remember the bell-shaped curve. There are a lot of good ones, and you were defending them about nutrition because they're not trained in medical school. That's a horrible defense to me. That's a horrible defense.
I think it's sad that they don't get nutrition training in this school.
No one is pushing them to train people. Why? Because of what's called the Flexner Report that was put out by the Rockefeller Foundation in the 1920s that tried to describe what needed to be taught and what couldn't be taught in medical school, and the primary emphasis was on pharmaceuticals. And so that's what we have now. And medicine, the American Medical Association, have not changed the need for nutrition. Now, Andrew Wilde.
See, that's what I was hoping. I was hoping that had changed. I mean, that was my impression in the past, but I was hoping that had changed. And you're telling me, no, it has not. I know Dr. Wilde is a hero in that regard, I think.
Yeah, Dr. Wilde, who I was an intern with, was able to get nutrition into some people's thinking, or at least in his fellowship at Tucson in Arizona. But it hasn't really gotten into medicine in general because there's such an emphasis on technology, which includes increasingly more sophisticated and very effective treatments that are very expensive, and on pharmaceuticals paid for by pharmaceutical industries and marketed to physicians for them. But anyway, I was trained as a physician, and my training as a physician has allowed me to be able to say to you, and through this book and other books that I'm going to be writing, that there's something very useful about synchronicity, and that I'm trying to be able to get that idea into some of medicine and some of psychiatry, but it doesn't fit with the worldview that each of them have.
Well, there's so much that we didn't even get to. A lot of your experiences growing up as an athlete and playing football and being a dancer. So I think people will be intrigued by your book, even if they can't go along with a lot of what you say. So thank you for writing this book, Doctor.
And thank you for really understanding my intent, Nancy. And thank you for your questions and your own personal experience. It really helps bring the ideas across to others. And the one last thing to say, that you are a model for what this book is intended, is to remind people or even bring to their attention for the first time that meaningful coincidences happen in their lives and they can be very useful.
Thank you, Doctor. My guest has been Dr. Bernard Beitman. His book, Life-Changing Synchronicities, A Doctor's Journey of Coincidence and Serendipity. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
You see that? Man, have you seen what they're doing down there? One leaned back, eyes locked on the air. Yeah, it's twisted what they've made. We give them all they know, and yet they betray us. We handed them soil, rich and warm, yet they pluck the roots and leave only storm. Gave them water, deep and ancient, flowed from our hands. Now they poison its currents with iron bands. Gifted fire, warm and bright. Perhaps that was our oversight. All at our fingertips, gifts we drew. They were meant to build, to create, to grow. Yet all they do is leave sorrow in tow. The second sighed, his voice full of grief. Tell me, what were they thinking? What was the belief? They're not thinking, that's the whole damn thing. Taking our gifts, turning them into string, they twist what's pure, make weapons from the thread. Power and control wage endless dread. They never see the bigger view. They walk blind to the things they could do. He watched as a star flickered away. Did we make a mistake giving them this say? Freedom, choice, the power to burn, to break, to build, to crash and turn. I don't know, came the soft reply. Maybe they're still learning, still asking why. But it's like they destroy before they see. Could have made something, but they let it be. They scatter ashes where once was life. Everything we gave them slips through their sight. It wouldn't be so bad if it was just one or two, but it's like the whole world's drunk from that brew. You think they'll ever see the cost? Realize the price before it's all lost? Maybe they'll stop, maybe they'll change, but I'm not sure. The world feels so strange. I don't know, man. Hope they wake up soon. But they keep poking that fire, singing that tune. Eyes locked on the fire, but unaware of the burn. All the damage they've made with little to yearn. Guess all we can do is just see and wait. See them let the ashes fall and call it progress. Yeah, watch and see, the first one sighed, as the stars flickered silently wide. Braden Hansen.
Undertow. Feet sunk in the sand, I thought I was sliding. The beach racing the sky, and I slipping faster than sand through an hourglass. Jerry Mahood.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.